This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Through the years, there have been artists who have gotten their inspiration through science. Scientists getting inspiration through art? That's a whole nother thing altogether, and could perhaps create a whole new discipline.
So that was deeply influential on me. It made me start looking at the poetry in the science.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from an art professor who uses art as an exo-discipline. Then we'll try to find out why an overwhelming majority of students in veterinary school are women. And we'll spend an academic minute exploring the coral reefs in nice, warm water. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Combining art with science can create an entire new discipline. That's the big part of the work of Professor Thomas Asmuth. He recently delivered a lecture called Art as an Exo-Discipline. Thomas Asmuth is an assistant professor in the art department at the University of West Florida, specializing in digital and experimental media. We spoke recently about his work and what it says on his business card, artist or scientist.
It says artist, but my business card also has me in a pressure suit, a spacesuit. I already give people little clues that I'm not just a straight-ahead painter, if you would.
What started first, your interest in art or your interest in science?
Actually, my interest in science was earlier. I grew up in a community not too much smaller than Pensacola. And we didn't really have access to art museums and such at that time. And I had a real interest in nature and in observing. And so I ended up in a physics program right after high school.
And once you were in physics, is that where art started creeping in?
It sure did. I was up near Chicago, so our way to get away from school and get away from the studies for a little bit would be to go up there. And Chicago is just full of these amazing museums. And the Art Institute of Chicago is a citywide organization. And I actually have some of my first experiences of seeing a painting face-to-face there. At the same time, I was reading authors like Davies and his book called God and the New Physics, at which he talked about a more holistic look at how we think about knowledge and how we gain knowledge and how we sort of process knowledge. And so that was deeply influential on me. It made me start looking at the poetry in the science.
Did you know that you had artistic talent? Like, could you draw when you were a kid?
I drew enthusiastically, but nothing that I drew would be super realistic or like of a highly trained nature. Diagrams, lots and lots of early sketches my mom still has.
So we do that, yes.
Yeah.
So I guess I want to say like, when you started seeing the poetry in the science, when does that transform itself into art?
Sure. Well, it started transforming me almost immediately. Both the influences of thinkers in physics and in art. I was just very visually moved when I was looking at the work in Chicago. I was also very intellectually moved by who I was reading, and I was thinking about philosophy and such. And so I ended up moving to California and started taking some drawing classes. And I pursued drawing and painting for almost 20 years with science kind of on the back burner.
Was there a particular incident or a particular person that really made you go, okay, yeah, this is it. This is where I'm going?
Well, I had finished up a bachelor's degree in painting. And my close friend Gareth Noyes is a physicist, and he enjoyed talking to me about my work. He enjoyed collecting my work. And he noted that there were formula or patterns that would show up. And he knew what they were about because of his background. And he asked me, why didn't I just go ahead and start doing some of the experiments I was making paintings about? And so I looked at Gareth and said, I don't know why I don't. What a great idea. And so one of the very first things where the crossover happened was I built these, they're rudimentary, but they are particle detectors made of household items. So it allows you to see things like cosmic rays pass through the vessel, or when a decay off a radioactive substance gives off a particle, you see the contrails that are left as that thing scoots across the vessel. And so those objects, they're called cloud chambers, became these theater objects. I actually would build an installation around them and let people sit there and see the unseen world. To me, that was very much like making a painting, because a painting's letting somebody see the unseen world.
It's the confluence of art and MacGyver.
Maybe. Yeah. Definitely an influence, and also Robert De Niro's character in Brazil. He's that renegade plumber, right, who breaks in the middle of the night and fixes the main character's plumbing problem. Yeah, I'm very, very hands-on.
So does the science... Does it enable you to take art places where most artists wouldn't even think about going?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but I would say that I get influence from both sides, and I'm not sure everybody else gets influenced by both sides. I'm constantly trying to build bridges across to drag one subject into the other or vice versa. And so I think people have similar thoughts about how they communicate, but they don't use the same methods that I do. I do have colleagues who do, but I don't want to say we're marginal. But there's fewer of us. There's fewer of us in the art world because I identify as an artist.
I guess you could turn the question around too, saying, you know, does the art help you take science places where science couldn't go? And I guess it's pretty much the same answer.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same answer. I think that there's those hemispheric sort of associations of the brain, and I'm really interested when the left and the right start influencing one another, and when I can talk about it and actually have people who are distinctly one-sided or the other understand where I'm coming from, why I'm excited about an idea, why it's an interesting thing to look at for a moment and contemplate or discuss.
How do students react to this, or how do you introduce it to students?
Students are very receptive. We are living in a really interesting age of non-specialization because of the access to all the information out there. It's just ripe opportunity. As for introducing them to it, I will teach classes. One particular class I teach, we study about the functions of components and how conductivity works, and we build kits. And then we figure out how do they translate out into an object. So then the design and art come in, and we start looking at, you know, how do humans use their machines? What kind of associations do you get when you hold this thing versus another thing? What does a teddy bear tell you that a toaster doesn't, right? And vice versa. So if you build this thing as a toaster, where's your audience? Who are you communicating? And what histories are you communicating with? And you could say the same about the teddy bear, right?
Is this something that can only be done with physics, or can the other sciences be involved?
Oh, no. I work with a lot of different aspects of science. I would say the project that I described before, I've delved into electrical engineering, physics, chemistry, optics, transmission sciences like the radio and wireless communications. So, yeah, it's looking at science and technology and at art as sort of a method of communication. And where do they overlap? And where haven't I seen them overlap before? Try to put them together.
Art as exodiscipline.
Yes.
What are we talking about?
What we're talking about is it's my attempt to explain the schizophrenic sort of mindset that I work in, I guess. It is me trying to explain to people how I ping pong back and forth, or I move fairly freely, fairly effortlessly through science and art and combine the things. And I'm not afraid of bringing media of one into another. And so it's a word that I tried to put together to try to explain that. I don't know if discipline means as much to my practice as it does to other researchers, to other practitioners. So I'm just thinking about outside. So exoplanet, exodiscipline. Okay, yes. All right. This is my posture here to talk about the advantages and also responsibilities and sometimes disadvantages of not tying yourself too deeply to a specific discipline.
And you've got a whole hour on this.
Yeah, at least.
What would you rather be known as? I mean, once it's all said and done, would you like to have great discoveries in art or great discoveries in science?
Well, then I think I start dropping into the disciplinary thing, and I'm pretty uncomfortable with that, Bob.
I'm trying to label you. I really am.
Okay. How about a thinker? I can handle saying I'd like to be known that I contributed to the thoughts of the world.
Thomas Asmuth is an assistant professor in the art department at the University of West Florida, specializing in digital and experimental media. Still to come, if you talk to a veterinary student, you're most likely talking to a woman. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Women are underrepresented in a lot of scientific fields, but there's one branch of biological science that bucks that trend: veterinary science. Women now make up the majority of veterinarians in the U.S. and fill close to 80% of the seats in vet schools. The Marine Mammal Center in the Marin Headlands of California is a good example of this trend. The center is a combination emergency hospital, rehabilitation center, and research institute for seals, sea lions, sea otters, whales, dolphins, and others. 70% of its paid staff and 73% of the volunteers are women. From the radio series Cross Currents, Jen Cheehan reports.
It's a sunny day at the Marine Mammal Center. The animal pen area is bustling. Seals and sea lions are housed here, one, two, or three at a time, in individual chain link enclosures, each one containing its own small concrete pool. Outside one pen, a group of about five women are gathered around, getting their game plan together.
We're going to start with Boomer and F2, and then we're probably going to have to sneak out and go do Eloise, and then come back and do admits after.
That's Dr. Lorraine Barbosa. She's a veterinarian. Boomer is a young sea lion, about the size of a Labrador retriever. He's hurt. He has cuts and gouges on several areas of his body.
Why don't you pull me some dry gauze off of the cart?
Barbosa squirts an orange liquid into the wounds. A volunteer restrains the sea lion in a kind of kneeling wrestler's stance, straddling the young animal while holding its head firmly against the ground. Most people here, interns, volunteers, vet techs, are well trained in restraining their charges.
We're very careful with these guys because they are wild animals, so even though they're sick and injured and cute, we try to approach them as we would a wild animal because they can be potentially dangerous in terms of biting us.
Women make up the bulk of the workforce here, about 45 paid staff and an army of 800 volunteers. At any given time, there may be 80 to 100 people at the center, showing school groups and visitors around, doing administrative or research work, or caring for the animals.
We're just going to get everybody in, throw in the fish.
Part of that care is keeping these wild animals from getting too used to humans. All around the pen area, stacks of flat wooden boards with metal handles lean against the fences. People hold these boards in front of their bodies like shields as they approach the animals. Once one has been cornered, a wet towel gets wrapped around its head as a temporary blindfold slash muzzle. Then they go down all in one motion into that wrestler's stance.
And then can you pass me some more gauze? Sorry, little buddy.
But it doesn't always go smoothly.
Please.
Are
you okay?
One of the vet interns trying to look at Boomer's teeth has gotten a bite on her thumb. She goes off to clean her own wound while the rest of the crew finishes up Boomer's exam.
Is it warm?
No.
Satisfied with Boomer's progress, the team lets him go and retreats from the pen. Barbosa started here as an intern herself while she was still in vet school. She works here on an as-needed basis. When she's not nursing sick sea lions back to health, Barbosa cares for dogs and cats at her small animal practice in Santa Rosa. She says there are a lot of similarities between the two kinds of work.
I go and use skills I've learned here on mean yappy chihuahuas back in my small animal practice because I'm like, oh, that's a great way. We restrain them with towels too. Usually not wet towels, but you know, similar. Yeah, I love it. I feel like I have the best of both worlds.
So it's a great way of combining, I think, thinking about science is it combines science with a concern for animal welfare. You know, so we're mixing those two different passions and interests.
That's the Marine Mammal Center's senior scientist, Dr. Francis Gulland. About 20 years ago, the center was looking for a vet to develop a research program around its animal care.
I thought I'd come here for a year and earn enough money to buy a truck and drive to Alaska. And instead, 20 years later, I'm here, still here, and there's just always more research to do.
Right now, she's working on several big ongoing projects, including looking at the effects of harmful algae blooms on marine mammal health and the prevalence of cancer in California sea lions.
1 in 5 of the California sea lions that come into our center and die have cancer, and that's really high prevalence for a wild animal. And we should be concerned because they share a diet with us, they're swimming in the same water as us.
That water contains toxins like DDT and PCBs, which turn up in the blubber of adult California sea lions. They also show up in human tissue. So far, they haven't found a direct connection between water pollution and increased sea lion cancer, but the research is ongoing. Still, Gulland says that veterinary medicine is often dismissed by those in so-called hard science.
I think there's a perception that, and that's what I sort of received as a child, that you're basically, you know, looking after dogs, and that's sort of cute and it's nice, but it's not science. But if you think about it, to repair a fracture involves understanding how bones heal. If you're trying to treat, you know, gastrointestinal disease, you have to understand how the intestines respond to infections and how inflammation works.
Veterinary medicine used to be a male-dominated field, but Gulland's seen a lot of change over the course of her career.
First of all, veterinary school when I was there was mostly men, but now within the vet schools, the majority of vet students are female. And then within the marine mammal community, all the older scientists were male. And now if you go to a conference of marine mammal scientists, it's probably mostly women, even though there's still some of the senior positions are still mostly male. But there's definitely a change.
So my thoughts are deciding between going ahead and getting her anesthetized now, doing some pre-op like cleaning and x-rays and stuff like that.
Dr. Lorraine Barbosa and her all-female crew have now moved into an exam room. They're preparing to put a sea lion named Eloise under anesthesia so they can check how she's healing from a flipper amputation.
But once you have it all set up, you're going to basically get pretty nice and snug on there because you're trying to create a seal, right?
Once Eloise goes under, the crew snaps into quiet, efficient action, getting her quickly onto the table, placing a tube into her mouth, and preparing surgical instruments and medications.
Is she pretty deep? She looks like... I'm going to put her on two.
One of the women gathered around the operating table is Joelle Sweeney, who's in her last year of vet school. She started here as a volunteer.
It's a dream place for me, and I'd love to come back and work as well.
If she does come back to work here, she'll be following in the footsteps of some strong women scientists. In the Marin Headlands, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
Cross Currents is a production of KALW in San Francisco. And as long as we're at the ocean, let's go a little deeper and see what's going on in the coral reefs offshore. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Ecosystems are complicated and have surprising interconnections. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Cliff Ross, an associate professor of biology at the University of North Florida, is studying mosquitoes in order to survey the health of coral reefs.
Since the 1970s, coral reefs around the globe have declined by over 50% due to human activities such as pollution and climate change. When corals reproduce, they release tiny larvae into the water column. These newborn corals float around at the mercy of the currents for hours to months. This floating existence is a critical time point for corals, as they can be exposed to many different types of stressors. Why is this important? If the larvae don't live, then you won't have adults. Pesticide exposure is one such type of stressor. In the Florida Keys, larval release not only coincides with seasonal rains, but also coincides with the hatching and development of mosquitoes. In order to better understand the effects of pesticides and temperatures on coral larvae, we used individuals from Parides asteroides. Following exposure, survival and settlement were measured. We also quantified sublethal stress in the larvae by using unique cellular assays. These assays work much like a blood test in humans, where you can identify if an individual is sick and to what extent. While our results suggest that some larvae may have a moderate degree of resistance against short-term exposure to ecologically relevant concentrations of pesticides, the results are far from being clear-cut. Results were variable and dependent upon the pesticide type, the temperature used, and the type of biomarker being examined. In the ocean, where so many stressors can interact, our work is significant in that it serves as a warning to other scientists. What's the warning? When dealing with cases of multiple stressors, things can get quite complex and differential responses can be encountered. We still have a lot to learn about corals.
That was Cliff Ross of the University of North Florida. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.